CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Reports. I'm Jonathan.
And Ramon is present. Jonathan Witt, how are you doing?
I'm well, and yourself?
I'm good. The whole Twitter is awry. Not awry, whatever.
Outrage.
Burning witches in the digital realm.
I don't know. We are actually tweets. Recording this quite close to the release. But by next week, this is Friday now, by next week, we may very well find that we've forgotten about the current outrage. So we haven't mentioned what it is yet. So whatever you're outraged about on Twitter,
right,
that's what we're talking about.
It was Helen Zillow, who's one of my favorite people to follow on Twitter, by the way. And she follows me, so there we go. She's one of my favorite people to follow because she says these things off the cuff. And like, she has no filter,
which is
great.
Do you think it's always off the cuff?
Yes. No, I think she's very intuitive. She's like, this idea sounds good. Let me talk about it quickly. So there's an insinuation that she said some parts of colonialism had positive effects. Now, I tend to disagree with that. Jonathan does agree with that. So even we don't agree on this. But so we have a guest to talk about what he thinks the real crux of the matter is.
Yeah, so, The main tweet that caused the trouble was, for those claiming legacy of colonialism was only negative, only in capital letters, think of our independent judiciary, transport infrastructure, piped water, etc. And it's caused massive outrage. Everyone is very upset because it's now a justification of colonialism.
Not everyone, Jonathan. Please, some people are outraged.
Everyone.
Twitter does not mean anything.
Everyone's
in this country.
Everyone's gone absolutely. Everyone, every single last person. And Ramon, do you want to introduce our guest for the week?
Indeed. So our guest is Wessel van Rensburg. He's a South African living in London at the moment. He did an LLB at Tuckies, and he was the youngest member of the TRC Investigations Unit, specifically investigating the massacres of Sebokeng and Boy Patong. And he left South Africa in 1998 and is currently the head of digital marketing at Trinity Mirror in London. So, Wessel, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
No, the pleasure is all ours. So, I mean, Jonathan, we had a plan to have a show about colonialism and the effects of it for quite a while now. And then Auntie Helen comes out and just like destroys all our momentum. So we had to jump into it quickly.
Yeah, no, and here we are. Here we are discussing it, and hopefully some useful discussion rather than what we've seen over the last couple of days.
Indeed, even between us, because we disagree on this.
Yeah, I think we do. I think we do.
Because you're wrong. But anyway, nevertheless, Wessel, once again, thank you. So this furore over colonialism and infrastructure, how useful is it really, if you think about it?
So I have to say, when I started tweeting about this, I only saw the one tweet of Helen. As often is the case with Twitter, it kind of you grab onto one tweet and you get the things out of context. But in the tweet that most people were referring to when they expressed their outrage, she mentioned something about not everything was bad about colonialism, and she mentioned, I think, pipes or whatever, something about infrastructure. And I'm actually one of the people that thinks she's wrong, but not for the reason that most other people say she's wrong. So I think this whole case is a great example of how South Africans misunderstand their history, and also of philosophical and I think we can unpack that a bit.
We're gonna have to just restart a little bit there. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry, Wessel. It stopped numerous times. So let's go to audio if that's possible, and then I'll just ask the question again. Okay. Is that all right?
That's fine. Yeah.
Sorry about that. From the time you answered. Cool. Ready to go.
Yeah. So I just want to firstly say that the thing we're going to talk about today is specifically referencing one tweet that she sent. She sent actually quite a few, but it was the one where she mentioned, I think, pipes, and that not everything bad about colonialism was bad, hence the thing about infrastructure and colonialism. But she actually said quite a few other things which were interesting as well, which a lot of which I actually disagreed with, but not with the reason most South Africans are disagreeing with her. And I think this is a great case to unpack how South Africans misunderstand their history and also are confused philosophically, this whole thing about colonialism and infrastructure and whether colonialism was good or bad.
So what do you mean by we are... What do you mean by the fact that we are ignorant about our history, so to speak? I mean, we know what happened, right? So are you talking about the effects of that?
Well, okay. So I think most people that criticized her were completely correct in stating that colonialism in general, especially as experienced in Africa, was mostly kind of extractive. In other words, you'd have these colonial governments being set up that were basically only doing the bare minimum to keep order and to export products back to what they would call the mother country. That critique of colonialism, which is the kind of criticism lots of people leveled against her, is completely correct. But the problem is in South Africa, that wasn't the case. For example, there's a paper out by an African economist which shows that South Africa's investment in infrastructure as a percentage of GDP during the National Party's rule was around 7%, while now it's only 3%. That 7% for that whole period is an extraordinarily high figure. It beats all the World Bank averages and so forth. So there's a immediately it what everybody is talking about doesn't seem to apply to South Africa. So that's the first point which we could discuss.
All right, but the infrastructure do you call it colonial if the Afrikaners did it? Because I wouldn't call the Afrikaners a colonial power as such.
Yes, neither would I, although you could say they have aspects of colonialism. But it's interesting to see that AfriForum has come out in support of Helen Zille, which I'm very surprised about because they obviously don't know their own history. And I've also seen AfriForum tweet things every now and again, which makes me think they are very much new liberal in their thinking now, which I find interesting. But that's an important point. But it's also a point that Helen Zille didn't make, because Helen Zille herself is a liberal, and she couldn't bring herself to say something that the apartheid government did was good. So she also referred to this nebulous kind of colonialism thing. And I think one of the big problems in South Africa is that people bunch apartheid and colonialism together as if it's the same thing, and it's very different things. And it's an example of how our history is very confused. And one of the results of that is that we are very focused on race instead of other things. Because if you look at the finer detail of South African history, you'll find lots of interesting like nuances and differences between whites, for example, around issues like colonialism, and ways that you could find links between the different race groups. In terms of Afrikaner history and black South African history, but which is shunned in favor of these very simplistic, broad brushstroke ideas.
Wessel, do you think maybe we could just have a couple of definitions? Because here it gets a bit complex in terms of what you're saying. Number one is, I don't think we're particularly steel-manning Helen's argument, because we're now deciding what she meant by colonialism, which time period she was referring to. And things do get quite complex in the South African space, where we say things like there's been oppression for 400 years. You know, the apartheid wasn't 50 years long, it was 400 years long, and things like that. So it gets quite complex. So for the purposes of the discussion we're having, can we say what we think colonialism is? From my perspective, I'm not including the sort of 50 years of apartheid and the nationalist government. how do you see it?
No, I would agree. I think the kind of thing that most people say when they discuss colonialism is this idea of an outside power coming in and basically then extracting resources and so forth. And that's colonialism. And I would agree with that definition.
Okay, so if we're going with that kind of definition, what is the central issue with saying, you know, a bunch of people came in, they kind of stormed into the country, did whatever they wanted to in most parts of the world. That's how colonialism worked. You know, they didn't really care about the natives. In some instances, killed off many of the people who were the native inhabitants. But just by the fact that they move to that area, they take with them their, for example, knowledge or infrastructure that creates. They take with them their culture. That automatically means that something exists in that space that didn't exist before. So, yeah. If we're going to have an honest discussion about a potential good that may have come, and it may have been unintentional, it may have only come about many years or decades later. I think it's dependent on what the specifics are, but what is the fundamental problem with making the kind of argument that Helen Zitter and other people have made? Frankly, we had David Bullard on the show, who got fired for making similar arguments.
Yeah, well, look. I mean, where I agree with this argument is that I think that that cultures and languages are basically, for lack of a better word, precious. And you know, the whole idea of nationalism comes from what they call the romanticism. So it's a very romantic idea, the idea of societies and cultures forming nations. And so I think there is something wrong when some big outside force just comes in and just changes everything, or just by doing that. So in that sense, I agree with the kind of outrage and the hurt that people feel when something like colonialism is brought up. But if you look at Africa's case, it's a very peculiar. When the so-called Dutch came to the Cape, I mean, it was never the Dutch government that decided we're going to colonize South Africa, right? They wanted to go east and they wanted to provide foodstuff for their ships, right? There was an industrial dispute. They had a bunch of farmers working for them to supply these ships, working as indentured labor, which is kind of a form of light slave labor, who had they had industrial dispute. And these guys went freelance and said, you know, we're not going to work for Dutch East India Company, which was like Walmart with gunships, basically. And that's how the colonization of South Africa started, without the force and the kind of policy of a state behind it. It was ordinary workers who were being exploited. That's the start of colonialism in South Africa. So it's an extremely complex topic in South Africa's case, and something that most people don't engage with.
All right.
So let's start. Well, let's actually start with the premise at hand. So did colonialism actually build infrastructure that has been useful to South Africa? And you argue that in South Africa's case, it's a bit different from other African countries, and you'd argue perhaps yes, there was some positive infrastructural aspects of colonialism. Am I being generous?
Yeah, well, look, let me first say this. You know, the ANC was heavily influenced by the South African Communist Party, and they brought up the Freedom Charter, and they said South Africa belongs to everybody that lives in it, right?
Right.
And so when the ANC talked about South Africa, they talked about, because they couldn't, and that's kind of under the influence of the South African Communist Party. So I mean, that's just quite an interesting aside. But my point is that Africa and what I think is what problematic about the rest of Africa and problematic with left discourse is that Africa has not had a nationalist moment, and that the countries tend to nation states are, in my opinion, extremely important for countries to develop. Yet we have a discourse of black nationalism, of African nationalism, which claims to be nationalistic, but actually is crosses borders, which is kind of global in its scope, right? And it's actually the kind of philosophy of an elite, right? And which is one of the reasons why many African countries, that even though they claim they're African nationalist, have not developed, right? And I think what's interesting about Afrikaner nationalism is that I think it's an authentic form of nationalism. Now, I don't pretend that everything that nationalists have done is good. In the early 20th century or 19th century, when it started in Europe, nationalism was seen as a left-wing movement, uniting ordinary people against corrupt European elite. But then we know what happened later on with Nazism and stuff. So it's a double-edged sword. But the thing is, you need nationalism to be able to mobilize a state and to have a strong state, and for an essential for development. And if you look at what the Afrikaner nationalists did, although it was for Afrikaners, mainly, not even mainly for whites, you know, it was basically for Afrikaners. They did not take the infrastructure to the Netherlands or whatever. They basically, or the capital, they invested it inside the country to build roads, railways, Eskom, one of the world's biggest power generators, and so forth.
Okay, so two things for me there. Number one is that seems to fight against the argument that there benefits from colonialism, because I mean, you just cited Eskom, not everyone will love as an example, but until 20 years ago, you could have happily cited it around any dinner table and no one would have fought with you that Eskom was a good example of a really well-functioning utility which provided a good service at a good price. So you've given an example there and a couple of examples of things that happened as a result of this nationalism, this colonialism. And once again, I know I'm harping on it, but I'm going back a bit to the, okay, so where is the nothing good came out of colonialism?
I'm not saying nothing good came out of colonialism. And by the way, I want to say, I don't think you can call Afrikaner nationalism colonialism, because it was an anti-colonial movement in and of itself.
It was anti-British colonial, right? So it's just, it was the one group of guys who you could argue settled here fighting against the other group of guys who came along a little bit later and were like, you know, we also want a piece of the pie.
Yeah, I mean, that's a simplistic way of saying it. But, I mean, nationalism as defined originally has got certain specific characteristics. And, I mean, Afghan nationalism ticks all those boxes. And one of the big characteristics of nationalism is that it kind of looks after its own in the sense of its poorest and its destitute, and it tends to be a democratic movement within the group. It sees itself as part of that group, and all of these things are important things that we need in Africa. Sorry, I don't know if I'm answering.
No, I think I kind of guess your point. So in order to develop a country, maybe not today, but maybe a while ago, you needed a sense of identity, which is nationalism. And we did it along racial lines in South Africa. And the Afrikaners were the ones in power at the time. And because they were nationalistic, they actually developed the infrastructure for themselves, particularly for Afrikaners, so to speak.
Yeah.
So colonialism itself does not supply infrastructure because it's extractive, which I tend to agree with. However, the nationalistic tendencies of the Afrikaners produce the infrastructure. Therefore, Helen Zille is incorrect in her statement.
Yeah, no, I had said at the time I disagree with her statement, but not for the reason everybody else is saying. But just to go, one thing where she might have a point is just to give you an example of how complex these things can be. a very important component of Afrikaner nationalism was played by companies like Sanlam, right?
Yeah.
And Afrikaners used to be poor, uneducated hillbillies, right? Had the skill to run that the chief financial officer, the first one of Sanlam, wasn't an Afrikaner; it was a Scot, right? Because Afrikaners didn't have the skill,
right?
So you know, you can't say everything about contact with this colonial other is bad, right? You can sometimes appropriate some of it and use it. Are we going to reject Christianity because it's Christianity colonial by par excellence?
Well, I think this is the whole point. This is the whole point that she was making. Just to put it into context, as far as I understand, Helen Ziller goes off to Singapore for a couple of weeks, is shown around Singapore a whole bunch of things. You'll note one of the tweets that was ignored by everyone was a photograph she took, obviously, in some museum exhibition, whereby they showed some sort of computer games that kids play in Singapore, all about sort of taking responsibility for yourself and being accountable. It's convenient to ignore these things, which we have a problem with in our country. It's very obvious today. Not the first time, because you could argue Jacob Zuma, but for the first time, our constitutional court says to a politician, you know, you screwed up and you're going to be responsible for it personally, which is fantastic. But we don't have a culture of accountability. She goes to Singapore. She gets assumptively this tour. She gets told the history of Singapore more deeply than she probably understood it before. And she's coming back. She's literally in the airport as she comes back and is reflecting on the successes of this other country from her perspective. Now, she may not be 100% correct and all of these things. And obviously, the point is up for debate. But that's exactly what she's done. She's turned around. If you look at the stream of messages that she's posted, she's turned around and said, these are the things she thinks Singapore has done correctly. They have recognized their colonial past. They have recognized the evils of that past, but they've also recognized some of the good, if you can call it that. People don't like good because they judge it in a moral sense. But the spin-offs that have resulted that we want to keep out of that. And once again, I'm back to, you know, where you are right now in saying that there are potentially some things that result out of it. And the numbers are numerous and they're very difficult. It's very difficult to gauge because, it's been said, we've been having a discussion on our group that we have. And it's difficult to say, you know, if no one lands here in the 1600s, South Africa is completely ignored for some reason. Untouched. In 2017, is South Africa the exact same country it is now? Arguably not. In fact, almost definitely not the same country. Sorry, you were going to say?
No, I say most definitely not.
Yeah, but is South Africa, you know, the things that Helen Ziller refers to, does South Africa have the level of infrastructure? You know, she talked about piped water. She talked about, a justice system.
Judiciary system,
does South Africa have those things? She went on with someone else to make a comment about modern antibiotics and things. Does it have those things? And it's difficult to say because one person said it's sort of in an alternate sort of factual world, in a post-fact world, or in another universe, essentially, where no one touches South Africa, we would never know. I'll argue that there are some places across the world, and there are some cultures and peoples that were untouched by colonialism, and after colonialism, untouched by Western culture, and they're not better off, and they haven't reached the levels of progress that the rest of the world, at least those who adopted Western values, and many of those who were colonized, they haven't reached those levels of productivity and success.
Well, I kind of agree and don't agree. South Africa had, Africa countries had generally the same level of development, bar South Africa, put South Africa aside, as South Asia 30 years, 40 years ago. Those countries now are streets ahead of most African countries to our north, right? The difference is that Western that most African countries look far more to the West and to their colonial ex-colonial countries than those Asian countries. All of these African countries speak the languages of the colonizers, while Malaysia, for example, Malaysia and Ghana's population was or GDP was more or less the same at the time of independence, which was more or less the same time. Malaysia has taken an extreme nationalist position, right? They call the Malay cultural people sons of the soil, Bumiputras, right? So it's basically National Party redux. But they've developed economically. They're not speaking English, right, as their language of government. Now, So I disagree with almost everything that Helen Zelis said, except actually the point she made on the language issue, on English. She, one of her tweets, she mentions English. Now, that realization of her, the importance of English, I would say is actually, converse, funny enough, a nationalist realization. You can't have a country where speaks one language and ordinary people and the kids at home speaks another language, right? That it's a recipe for inequality, for social division, and so forth. And there's not an example of a country that's been colonized where the majority of the population is basically the original population, like South Africa is, that speaks that uses the colonial power's language as the main language, that has a successful economy or is equal, right? It just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
The only exception to this rule is Ireland. But what happened in Ireland? You had the potato famine. Hundreds of thousands of people died, and the poor Irish parents taught their children leave the country.
So sorry, just to repeat that, we had a Skype breakup. So you were saying the about the Irish children, yeah. What they taught their children.
Except for Ireland, and the Irish parents taught their children English because they wanted them to immigrate to the United States. So basically, within two generations, everybody became English speaking, and then Ireland started developing. So my point is not that English is good, but you need to have one national language which everybody speaks, right?
Right.
That is a nationalist principle, right? I'm glad to see that Helen Zelis got some nationalist principles, but with the rest, most of everything else he said, I disagree.
So let's go back to nationalism. So your argument is that nationalism actually is the reason why we have infrastructure in South Africa, specifically Afrikaner nationalism, and you argue that other African countries did not have nationalism. But, I mean, they did, in a way, didn't they? I mean, Julius Nyerere was a big nationalist. The problem is their policies were really shit.
But a good essay to read is Franz Fanon's In the Wretched of the Earth. One part of it is the national question,
yes.
Right? And he describes these people calling themselves nationalists and how they fight amongst each other, because normally the colonists came in and they only focused on one region or the capital because that's all they cared about. Yes. They didn't care. And then that particular capital, it was in a certain area and people spoke a certain language, and anyway they drew their own borders, and then these guys were benefited, and so they were speaking the language of nationalism, but actually it was this one group was benefiting. And he talks about corruption, about elites, and you can see it now in the Organization of African Unity. It's basically a talk shop of the elites of Africa, right?
Yes.
And it's exactly what caused all the nationalist revolutions in the 1800s. Is everything that is Africa, and that's the problem. It's defined in terms of race, and instead of saying it's Swana nationalism or Zulu nationalism. It's exactly because it's defined so widely that you have this problem in Africa. It's not nationalism, basically.
Right, and it's a sort of ethnic nationalism in a way.
No, it's not ethnic because it's ethnic implies some kind of cultural kind of affinity and shared history.
But if we look at the world today, I mean, North Korea is extremely nationalistic, but it's a crap place to live in, right? So, whereas South Korea is not. I mean, they're both nationalistic, but in two different degrees.
Yeah, I'm not saying all national states are. There's lots of factors that goes into developing a state, but I think a good it is almost always a requirement to have a nationalist phase in a country's history. One other thing is, I think, you know, you always hear, and I think you guys might be, but you always hear libertarians talking about Singapore or whatever. It's an extremely bad example to compare it against any nation state because it's a city state.
Yes.
By definition, it's quite easy to set up a city and then have finance and the regional companies set up their head office in that city and then be a success. It's much harder than to be next door Malaysia and it's a successful economy and to spread the wealth widely amongst the population. That is a much bigger achievement. We should much rather look at Malaysia than we should look at Singapore.
Well, for South Africa, I would tend to agree, but all we look at is, well, nowhere really, the treasury for how much money we can get very soon. I mean, there's no grand plan, I'm afraid, for the ANC in the past decade. So, I mean, I agree with you. I keep saying, well, if only there was a precedent we could follow, you know, somewhere in the world, and Malaysia is one of them, but no one mentions them at all in the political discourse we have in this country.
No. And it's quite interesting, just because when it got its independence and from who it got its independence. I think it's a really interesting example.
Right. So now,
can I
jump in?
Okay. So, just the nationalism thing is bothering me a little bit. Who has got nationalism right?
Well, I would say almost. Their name is a successful nation state, and they had a nationalist.
I tell you why, because it kind of sounds like nationalism is it's a sort of repetitive thing that I keep bumping into. Nationalism is a great idea, just nobody's done it properly.
No, hang on. Nationalism has got a long, long, long history, right? Yeah. So you had the French Revolution, right? So, Fichte, who's like one of seen as the kind of father of nationalism, was a big German, was a big fan of the French Revolution until Napoleon invaded Germany. And then he turned into a nationalist. And he kind of said, you know, cosmopolitanism is great, but how do we get there? You first need to make your own country work before you can make the world work, right? And that was the ethos. You know, when Garibaldi, who united Italy against their kind of the royals. I want to say Adlicus. The royals in Italy.
Yeah, the monarchy.
When he came to London, the monarchy. When he came to London, he was seen as a left-wing revolutionary, and the monarchy over here were really scared. So nationalism was a very important part in European development. And I mean, if you look at people like Hegel and stuff, he saw the impact of nationalism and the power of the nation state's bureaucracy that was brought to being because of it. And what could be achieved through it. Now, of course, it's got extremely destructive power as well. But I'm not saying what I'm saying applies now to Europe today. But I'm talking about where Africa is today.
So what do you make about the rise of nationalism in the Western world at the moment, with the rise of Donald Trump, Brexit, that sort of thing? I mean, is it the type of nationalism that you see as helpful or not really?
Because Russia was the one that kind of started a lot of it. Putin started it. Nationalism initially was a kind of reaction against empire and anti-colonial. And Putin is basically trying to rebuild the Russian Empire. So I don't think it's a great example of nationalism. But I do think that liberal elites and stuff in the West have left their working class behind and has not this is kind of the reaction because of that. But it can have very nasty consequences.
Right, because, I mean, 2016 was the year between globalism on one side and nationalism on the other side. So, I mean, do you think nationalism actually has any point anymore? Because globalism has achieved a lot of the good things that nationalism claims to have promised.
I don't think it has achieved those things necessarily. We might need to come to a point. Look, climate change is a good example where you need to have people working together across nation states and stuff. But other than that, I have yet to see a better vehicle for addressing all kinds of issues, including inequality, than the nation state. So I don't think it's days done. But I think the point I'm trying to make more importantly is that in Africa's case, nationalism, largely because of the contributions of people like Fanon and Sartre and whatever, and their ideology about nationalism, has been completely overlooked as a tool for development. Another thing is, you know, the debate about xenophobia in South Africa, and I think it's kind of linked, right? A lot of the liberals and also Marxists and whatever would say, now, open borders, whatever. Now, colonialism is a form of extreme open borders in a way. And I think people are hypocritical. If you look at the economic literature around this case, or around these cases, for example, in the UK, if the UK has a free movement inside the EU, which are lots of very developed countries and kind of semi-developed countries, and that has a small influence on the salaries of the poorest Brits, right? People use that as an argument to say, you know, the influence is not that big. Basically, it's all just racism and so forth that these working class people are displaying against immigrants. The thing though is if there was no open borders for the whole rest of the world, right? Then it wouldn't just be a small, insignificant kind of part of the working class who would pay a price in terms of what kind of salary they could earn. It would be really significant and it would utterly change the country. But the point I'm trying to make is I find a lot of this kind of cosmopolitan, wealthy, middle-class people pontificating about the poor, and also in South Africa, that they're so xenophobic. I just find it hypocritical, especially if you're a left-wing and you want to uplift the country. If South Africa had a proper healthcare and so forth, then and had open borders, it would be impossible. Right. So if you want to have a strong social state, you can't have this kind of open immigration policy. Right. And so
to have a social welfare state, you can't, which we have, you can't have an open borders policy. I agree with that.
But you can't. But if you listen to the way a lot of people are going on social media, you know, and a lot of people are left wing saying, we should just have open borders, but it can't work that way.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure if we agree on the reason why. I very much feel that we can't have open borders because if you come to South Africa, for example, if we open the borders and you just come to South Africa from wherever you like, as the current situation exists, and you become indigent, Essentially, our system is set up so that the state then has to look after you, which means the taxpayers have to look after you, and we already have a ridiculous burden on the taxpayers. And that's no different in first world countries. The same argument applies to why America can't have open borders, and the reason is the same. To an extent, there's a social welfare state. If you get rid of the social welfare state and you don't make the government responsible for looking after every individual, and you make individuals responsible for themselves and communities responsible for themselves, then you can open the borders all you like. It doesn't make a difference. If we go back a few hundred years, the borders made no difference because there was no government that, when you didn't have health care, for example, though I'm sure it was not exactly health care, but when you didn't have health care, the government wasn't expected to provide it. Either you had it or you didn't have it, or you someone else helped you with it, or it wasn't. So that's the issue around the open sort of borders argument. But I want to go back a little bit to something you said, which was in terms of successful, you know, nationalism and the success of nationalism. If why does it have to be, why do we have to have then nationalism at a state level? You already made the point that Singapore is a successful city. So, I'm sitting next to an anarchist, so he'll say to me, I can have a successful neighborhood. I don't need to worry about other neighborhoods or whatever. I might trade with them or do whatever I want. But why does it have to be at a country level?
You mean, could we have like loads of smaller units?
Yeah, well, why can't we have, instead of having 200 odd countries at a nationalist, I assume you know, a utopian idea for yourself would be something whereby we have 200 nationalist states, each state looking after the best interests of their individuals. But I'm saying, well, why don't we have rather 4,000 Singapores then?
Well, in theory, I don't have a problem if it works, but I do think that bigger nation states tend to have the same problems that supranational states have. It's harder to have equal societies, social cohesion in big states. So the smaller the unit, in some ways, the better. So I don't really disagree in theory with your point.
Is that not more about homogeny then? Because you know the examples that are commonly used is, and one of the reasons for also shouting down these examples is, if you use the Nordic countries as examples of sort of things, a way to follow, and everyone loves using them, left, right. You know, the left will tell you that they're socialist states. The right will tell you they're not socialist states. They're, you know, free markets. There's a little bit of truth in between. The point is that they've got a relatively homogenous state in that the people are all very similar. They all speak the same language. They all have very similar cultural beliefs. With regards to the Nordic states, the earnings are very similar. It's middle class and upwards. So, you know, it seems to work maybe as a principle when you've got homogeny like that. When you want what America likes to call the melting pot, or Canada calls the mosaic, you know, and I don't know, South Africa calls the rainbow nation. When you've got large differences amongst your population, can it function? Can it work?
No, I think it's very difficult for that to work. But I don't agree that – I think the two most important aspects that needs to be in sync is culture and language. And I don't think your race or whatever is important. And I think you can even have different religions within that, broadly speaking. But you need culture and language are the key things.
Yeah, look, I agree with you on race. I mean, because race doesn't inform people. this is the whole problem with attributing motive and just general action to race. Race doesn't generally inform how people do things, live their lives, etc. And that's one of the issues. I would disagree on the religion, because that does inform the way people live their lives and behave.
To an extent, yes. It depends. It depends on how secular the society is.
Okay,
how fair enough. It's yes, yeah.
That's why I love these type of conversations. We're talking about colonialism, and then now we're talking about what is the best way to run a country. It's quite interesting. So, Vessel, I mean, I'm going to put you on the spot here, I'm afraid to say. And I'm not trying to bait you in any way. Do you think that if we didn't have Afrikaner nationalism in the form of apartheid, we would have far less infrastructure than we have at the moment in South Africa?
I know these counterfactuals are so hard, but if we just look at countries that were undeveloped, that developed, like, you know, China is a recent example.
Yes.
And you know, the UK, when it did develop, it wasn't, they didn't have liberal policies. They had, but it was very statist. It was very nationalistic in many ways. So I don't think you would have had the same drive to build ISCOR or ESCOM in the same way. You mentioned earlier that 20 years ago we would have used ESCOM as a great example. Telkom is another great example. Do you know that South Africa had the fifth highest teledensity in the world in 1970, right? And that's including the so-called apartheid homelands, right? And some of the lowest calling costs, right? So I don't think a Liberal Party would have kind of achieved that, because according to liberal dogma, it's the free market's role to do these kind of things, so they won't invest as much money in them. And they would also – one of the important things about networks, like telecommunications network, is the wider it goes, the higher the value. It's exponential for everybody. And the problem with liberals is they normally focus their attentions on capitals and on big cities rather than spreading the network as wide. And so in the end, the value of the overall network is not as high. And I think it would have been very different, but exactly how it would have looked, it's impossible to say.
You made an interesting point in that if you look at the countries that have developed over the past century, none of them actually developed under liberal principles. So do you think the time has come for African countries to be extremely nationalistic? I mean, I think Rwanda is doing quite well in that regard. They're quite nationalistic at the moment.
And funny enough, it's quite nationalistic, isn't it?
Yes.
I would say yes, yeah. It is time. It's time for Africans to genuinely look after ordinary Africans instead of just pandering to an elite.
Right. I mean, and the question of actually choosing good leadership. I think that's been one of the huge failings of post-colonial Africa in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all connected. So, I mean, one of the things that I've been really interested in is the new kind of area of social capital, which is an area of sociology which kind of just asks the question, how much do you trust people of your own country that you don't personally know, right?
Oh, yes.
And there's been loads of studies done. So, for example, nationalism strongly correlates with high social capital. All kinds of other things like low corruption correlates with high social capital. And social capital is very low across most African countries.
So we're not very trustworthy. We don't trust each other very much at all.
No. Basically, this whole idea of Ubuntu is a myth, right?
Oh, yeah. I said that years ago. I got torn apart on Twitter. But yes, I agree with you.
A lot of culture in African countries is about your family and your immediate people around you, and that's quite normal human behavior.
Sure.
It's called reciprocal altruism. But the big difference that nationalism made is that it made your community, your imagined community, the left, some people on the left called it the imagined community, but it doesn't matter if it's imagined, it's still a community. It's much wider. And it has all kinds of effects. So from people stopping at red lights to reducing corruption.
Right. That's the thing with the Slav, well, Scandinavian countries rather. Hegemony is extremely strong there. Everyone looks the same. Everyone believes in the same values and principles. And so they have no problem in working towards a common goal collectively. I do find in a lot of other countries that's not the case, and people misdiagnose that as like socialism, or, you know, socialism in Denmark works well, but it's not socialistic in the slightest. They just have a group of people, or the population, who believe in the same thing.
Well, they depends on your definition of socialism. They're very heavily taxed, and the government spends cares, you know, free education, free healthcare.
The government doesn't own the means of production, like in Venezuela. No. That's socialism to me. You can have a very hardcore free market with a generous welfare system. It doesn't make it socialist.
Well, okay, we were calling about semantics. You could also say, for example, that Somalia during about 10 years ago was the example of perfect libertarianism.
It is in a way. Doesn't mean it's great, but yeah.
So I mean, that's extreme. I would say that the Scandinavian countries, and even Britain to the extent with the NHS, has got elements of socialism in a built on a capitalist economy.
Well, I think, you know, Bernie Sanders would agree with you. It's what democratic socialism. But, we are arguing definitions. I think I agree with Ramon on the definition there. But either way, with regards to South Africa, you've made a lot of points about nationalism and this, you know, the successes you believe that it brought for a minority in this country during the apartheid years, because that's how it was designed. We discussed the problem with this, you know, the community that's where the people have all different sort of wishes and wants and visions for their future. And, you know, you just said, you know, Ubuntu's basically nonsense. Where do we go in South Africa? Because we've now obviously got a great little Twitter storm and a little bit of outrage going. We'll have the DA shortly disciplining Helen Zille like she's some child. We are now going to even further probably have as a public discourse, because we've got, you know, the greatest philosophers of our South African times, you know, it's 2017, of course, denouncing all of this talk. So we can't have an honest conversation. We're going to move into the realm of there is no good that came out of colonialism, and there's no spin-offs and all the rest of it. It is all evil. While I type my message on Facebook using my iPhone and all of these things, which I believe are part of a greater system. So how does South Africa, if we wanted to be a nationalist state, how do we get there? Because to me, it's not possible.
Well, one way for sure, if you keep on just talking about race, you're not going to get to it, because South Africa is made up of people with different races. So this kind of obsession with race, and especially race, is such an essentialist thing, right, that you can't change. We'll never get there if that continues. I'm quite depressed about South Africa's prospects. I don't have any easy solutions. I think anybody that predicts where South Africa is going to be even 10 years from now is a brave, brave person.
Well, I'll be a brave person. Ramon, you want to be brave?
Must I predict what's happening in 10 years' time?
I'll give it a bash.
Okay, you go first.
Well, if I predicted on the, I suppose, positive possibilities, in 10 years' time, the ANC is no longer in power. The DA is. The problem with that is by then the DA has become ANC light, and it'll be very questionable whether that results in actual progress and success. So that would be where I think we're going to end up.
Well, I don't know if the ANC will leave power, even if they lose an election.
No, I suppose that's a possibility.
Right. I mean, well, that's about it, really. So we screwed, Vessel. Thank you for letting us know.
Let me say what I think could happen.
Sure.
I think one thing that could very well happen is the South African economy deteriorates further. And because of that, the country's balance of payments deteriorates further. So the currency weakens further. And it goes into basically a negative feedback loop, and there's a massive recession. And I think if you see, if you look at the ANC, how already people are organizing, although it's not admitted, along ethnic lines, this kind of, yep. If there's such crisis, this will just increase all of this and all the tensions around that. And I even think that South Africa as a unitary state is not guaranteed.
Well, I think that's a positive thing then. I mean, if we have homelands across the whole country without a federal state, I think that's quite good. I don't see a problem.
I think the how we get there could be extremely ugly.
Yeah. On that point, sorry, you've obviously had some background here in terms of this type of stuff and the violence related to it. There's a theory, a relatively common theory, that in 94 we didn't, and 93 really, we didn't actually avoid a civil war. We just postponed it. Your thoughts on that, given what you've just said?
If that turns out to be the case, it's not because we could have avoided the second part of the war. It's because of our own folly, really. And I think everybody's guilty, including people like who think they're the last people that are guilty. Or people like, for example, progressive Afrikaners and people like AfriForum, because I think everybody misreads South African history, where we came from and how we ended up where we did.
What is the one fundamental blind spot of these groups, now that you mention them?
I think people, for example, just to take AfriForum as an example, I've heard Aaron Roots, for example, say he's now a very big free marketeer, state must have a small role and so forth. And on the other hand, I heard the previous editor of the Mail and Guardian say to me, he thought it was great news that Siemens was taking over a part of Telkom's role because Telkom was now so inefficient and corrupt. The problem with both these positions is that without the state creating a platform for society to function properly, you have no hope whatsoever. And the South African Africans with the resources, basically the cosmopolitan class, have given up on the state, basically. They think that the private sector is going to solve all the problems, and it's not going to happen. And you know what? We were very close to a terrible war in 1994, and one of the reasons why we didn't have it to the extent is because the state was powerful enough to keep order to an extent, right?
Yeah.
The state doesn't have that power anymore. So if things get nasty now, it could get really, 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 really ugly.
Well, I mean, I do accept AfriForum and them's arguments. I mean, assuming that the state is a force for good, it's not anymore. It hasn't been for the past, arguably, centuries. But the past 10 years have been really shit.
The idea of a state, the problem is you have to fix the state. If you can't fix the state, then you have a problem. The state needs to work.
Well, yeah, I think we're stating the obvious here, but we can't force people to vote in a certain way, I'm afraid.
No, we can't, but we can change our arguments. If most South Africans think the private sector is the solution to everything.
To most things, it is.
Yeah, I have to say we're obviously at odds. We could probably go on for hours, but we're obviously at odds on this, because I think both of us do feel that it is the solution to most things. I'm going to sort of say that I don't think there's ever been a state. You know, you say we have to fix it. Well, there's never been a fixed state. Every state that's ever existed has, from the time it started to exist, has had things that needed to be fixed, because it is by its very essence dysfunctional. And the free market.
That iPhone you were just talking about just now, wouldn't have had it if it wasn't for states, right?
Why?
Why? Because states were fundamental to humanity's development. It created the security, the platform for economic growth,
Okay.
Everything.
But where is that different to where a libertarian would say, well, yeah, it's fine, have a state to protect the borders, to have police and to enforce the law through a judiciary. So there you've got your security. You can now set up your iPhone factory knowing that no one's going to storm in the middle of the night, steal your stuff, or murder you and make sure that that never happens.
Because you also need a few other things. You need public roads. If roads are private, people will tax you. They'll extract rents from that to mm-hmm. such extent that the economy will never take off. The same goes with telecommunications networks, right?
In South Africa, we have a telecommunications – let's get into this a little bit. We don't have that much time. But in South Africa, we now have a telecommunications network that was developed by the private sector completely. Mm-hmm. It's the cellular network. I'm going to leave out the fact that the government has at times owned portions of the companies because it's never been in power, in control of those boards. And the cellular network has been set up almost entirely by private companies. So there's an example of the state doesn't need to be involved.
So telecommunications is a really interesting example, and I'm glad you mentioned. Mm. As an example, that the only way to have a free market in telecoms is through regulation, right? So which is kind of contradictory. It works like the biggest network. Networks are by nature, if you add a little bit to a network, it just exponentially creates more economic value, right? So the biggest network would always swallow smaller ones. That's what happened in America with AT&T, where there was loads of regional networks, and over the years it quickly swallowed all the rest, and it was huge. And then America said, okay, we're going to – because they had this huge behemoth, instead of nationalizing it because they've got this ideology that you can't nationalize things, they said, okay, you stay a private company, but we're going to put regulations on you about what you're allowed to charge. Right, so American local phone calls for many years were totally free. You didn't pay for them. But AT&T was making such big profits because there was one network that they didn't care that they were regulated this way. Then later on, Reagan came, and then you had this ideology, no, we have to have a free market in every aspect of our economic life. And then what they did was they realized, actually, it doesn't make sense to have two networks in the same area, because then you have two pipes going down the same road and you dig up, it's kind of duplication of economic cost. Let's split it via the US, I think, was split into six different regions. So you had six different networks, each competed. And then at some point they said, oh, let's just lift all the regulations, let these guys compete. And what happened? The ones that moved first started swallowing the rest, right? So the point I'm making is that in certain avenues of life, it makes there's what called market failure. It just doesn't work. It must not sit in the private sector. And telecommunications is a great example. Now, in South Africa's case, you have the worst of both worlds. You have a company like Telkom, which used to be state owned, now is partially private, partially state owned, right? And bad regulation. South Africa's got some of the highest telecommunication costs in the world. While it had used when it was wholly state-owned, it had some of the cheapest and one of the world's most extensive networks.
All right. I don't know the data on the extensiveness. I'm not sure how easy it was to get a landline in Soweto.
Well,
and what we were comparing to, do you know what I'm saying? The world was less developed, so to be extensive back then was perhaps easier than being extensive now.
Perth highest tele-density, which means the fifth highest telephones per member of the population, and I'm not talking about just the white population. That is quite something.
Yeah. All right. Look.
Can I just use one more example?
Let's
take Korea, fastest broadband in the world, super cheap. Who owns the backbone? No telecommunications company, all three big telecommunications companies in Korea are partially owned by the state, and they need permission from the state to connect to any building and so forth. And it's got this fantastic telecommunications network.
I mean, I agree that the state can be a force for good and pragmatically, I'm an anarchist, yes, but pragmatically I do see reasons for the state. The problem is we've got a shit state, so I'm not going to trust it with anything at the moment. And until it improves and shows that it can behave itself on behalf of everyone else, well, fuck it. I'm not going to deal with them.
But the problem with that is, right, so I agree with you. Let's say we privatize electricity in South Africa completely, right?
Yeah.
So then suddenly you have a highly competent electricity provider that says, really, it's really uneconomical to ship energy, you know, really, because these guys in Johannesburg are very wealthy. I can charge them X, and I'm just going to focus on that. And forget about Alexandra, right? And what it will lead to is just more inequality, and it'll lead to basically.
But that's not how the free market works.
Yeah, it'll lead to
the free market works that someone will go, no one's providing Alex with power. I will.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
Very much so.
Yeah.
So I have the infrastructure spending across the rest of Africa, right? And see what percentage of the infrastructure spending across Africa is private, right? I'll send you a paper on that.
So there I'm going to agree with you on state stability, you see. So there's the example of why a country doesn't go into the Congo. And the answer is very simply because they have to invest millions and millions of assumptively dollars to go in there into a market they may not necessarily know. And they cannot be guaranteed security for a couple of reasons. Number one, there isn't security. And number two is you've got a corrupt state. If you sort those problems out, the public sector floods in and sorts out a lot of problems. Not sorts out a lot of problems. It's a bad example, and we're going to get into another argument about it. But the public sector gets involved. I think if you can't guarantee companies security, and I already agreed that that's part of responsibility of the state, you don't get them.
Yeah, but you know what? Companies and I only have one purpose. They need to make a profit, and that's fine, right? But the there are certain things, for example, security that you've mentioned, and other things as well. That takes time, and that's where the state needs to step in to create the platform.
Yeah, I mean, we can go on about this forever.
I
do agree with you in some ways. Other ways, I disagree. I think it depends entirely on the morality of the people in the state at a particular time, I'm afraid. But if we can work together, listen to me. I sound like fucking Oprah. If we can work together to make the state a better place, I think your argument holds a lot of water.
Okay.
I'm convincing. Well, Vessel, thank you. So Helen Ziller was wrong. Thank you. I was right. Thanks, Whit.
No, we haven't established
nationalism
that.
Is what caused the surge in infrastructure spending. And the reason why we are different from the rest of Africa is because they haven't had a huge nationalistic, what do you call it?
Surge,
hegemony.
I suppose.
Basically, that's it. I think that makes a lot of sense, and I tend to agree with you in that one. But nevertheless, Whit, any last words?
No, just thanks for joining us, Russell. It's much appreciated. Thanks for your insights. As we always say on the show, we don't have to agree, but it's nice to get differing views.
Yeah, I mean, and if you visit the motherland one day, please come in studio. We'll be happy to host you.
Great. Okay. Thanks a lot for having me. I enjoyed it.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours. Thank you so much, Russell. Speak soon.
Cheers. Thank you.
That's some interesting discussion.
I mean, interesting. I mean, the fundamental point is that his colonialism to him, and I tend to agree, was extractive. The institutions in place that they put in place were very ancillary, and they only applied to certain sections of the population, right? Mm. In South Africa, people did not have piped water after colonialism. They didn't have an independent judiciary. They didn't have whatever other examples were given. So colonialism itself is not the reason why we do better. He argues nationalism, specifically Afrikaner nationalism, is the reason. And that holds a lot more water in my eyes than the colonialism argument. However, many people would conflate the two and say both of it's colonialism, which is not true.
Yeah, I wouldn't conflate the two, but I don't think colonialism is always reductive. America was colonized. It wasn't reductive in any way. They didn't reductive is probably the wrong word, but it wasn't exploitatory of the land necessarily for no value to that land. So no one, the folks that went over, the Spanish and then the British and whoever went over to the U.S. wasn't plundering for resources, mainly because it doesn't have great resources. They went over there, they took their culture, and I think that that's what this comes down to for me. This is understanding that with colonialism came the West. And that's what colonialism brought to a lot of the world. That's what globalism now brings to a lot of the world. There are problems, obviously, and it's not perfect. And that's not to criticize. This is the problem. Is everyone, and everyone loves, you know, jumping to the Nazi example.
Not everyone, but some people.
For me, it's the reality is that places that have ultimately changed over to Western values, whether it be immediately, whether it be over time, are better places to live for everyone, regardless of race group, and regardless of everything else. And it's back to some cultures are just better than others.
Well, I mean, I agree about the cultures thing. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying Western culture is absolutely shit. It's the best one in my eyes, because I'm a white patriarchal Arab for some reason. I agree with you in that regard. I just think Mrs. Zilla's tweet was just very poorly worded, and it was wrong. It was wrong. Admit it.
No. I've said why. But look, we're going into a long podcast here, so we need to call it.
People like to hear us talk.
But I don't think it was wrong. I think that she had a point. I think that she also, and I hate using this, but in context, and what I mean by context is that she had 6 tweets in a row, basically, which all expounded on the same concept. And no, I don't think, firstly, any singular one of the tweets was particularly wrong. I thought her examples of piped water were a bit odd.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, being wrong.
They're a bit arbitrary.
I'm not dismissing her entire argument. I'm saying her examples are wrong. Well, the basic premise is here, people, just number your tweets. I think it makes a lot more sense.
That's the mistake she made.
Yes, very much
I'm sure that's what the DA Disciplinary Children's Committee will find.
That's what it's going to be about. Listen,
Ms. Zilla, we don't have a problem with what you said, but you should have numbered your tweets.
You learned how to type from 1 to 10, or count, rather. So just use that in next time, please.
Right, and on that bombshell.
Oh, thanks, Jeremy Clarkson. It is time to go. See you next week. And, yeah, enjoy whatever it is you do. Why am I sounding so fucking...
Right, you can find us on Facebook. You can also get onto our Facebook group, which has some interesting discussion going on pretty much all the time. You can find us on Twitter at @Renegade_Report. We will catch you next time. Thank you for listening. CliffCentral.com.